gonna ain't coming back. They're overseas. Might as well close the store.
Welcome to the Illinois Labor Hour for the January 10th, 2009 edition, brought to you on the air by WEFT 90.1 FM and webcast worldwide at www.wft.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some headline news for us, as well as a Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week is entitled, Just Maybe. Also here with us today is co-host Bob Polesny, our technical expert and advisor, who will have some news and banner for us. Now here's Tom with this week's news headlines. But first, some underwriting.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. The Illinois World Labor Hour is also supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, well, today we're going to be having a special guest who's going to be calling in live on the air for an interview. His name is Robert Austin. He's a member of the Chicago Industrial Workers of the World, and he's going to be talking a little bit about his eyewitness and participatory experience with the occupation of the Chicago Windows and Doors Factory in Chicago that happened right before the, well, basically back in December. So we're looking forward to that. And first, the news headlines.
A coal ash pond ruptured and sent a billion gallons of toxic sludge across 300 acres of East Tennessee last month. It was one of the 1,300 similar dumps across the United States, most of them unregulated and unmonitored, and which contain literally billions of gallons of fly ash and other byproducts of burning coal. Like the one in Tennessee, most of these dumps, which can reach up to 1,500 acres each, contain dangerous amounts of heavy metals, such as arsenic, lead, mercury, and selenium, which are considered by the Environmental Protection Agency to be threats to human health. The Tennessee Valley Authority, which owns the Kingston Fossil Plant, where the Tennessee spill occurred, has been trying for decades to fix leaks at its ash pond. According to a report in the Knoxville News Sentinel, in 2003, the TVA considered switching to dry disposal, but balked at the estimated cost of some $25 million. That was less than the cost of cleaning up an ash spill in Pennsylvania in 2005, but the Pennsylvania spill was only one-tenth the size of the present spill in Tennessee. In summary, and this is worldwide, there need to be jobs created in order to clean and virtually sterilize the waters we drink and absorb. Depending on your perspective, oil that is extracted from Canadian dirt is being portrayed both as saving America from energy dependence on the unstable Middle East or an environmental catastrophe in the making. As Barack Obama prepares to take office a week from next Tuesday, the debate is no longer academic. The president-elect has promised to move forward with an ambitious program aimed at fighting climate change. Not all oil is alike when it comes to environmental impact, and many environmentalists single out production from the oil sands as the epitome of dirty oil. In a recent study, the Rand Corporation estimated that oil from the oil sands generates 10% to 30% more greenhouse gases than conventional crude. Canada, in large part because of the production capacity of its oil sands, is now the largest supplier to the United States. But environmental groups in both the U.S. and Canada are pushing for a slowdown or even a halt to further oil sands development, which is concentrated in northern Alberta. Operators of oil sands projects and Canadian provincial governments are eager to point out the potential to reduce America's dependence on oil from politically unstable regions. Canadian oil sands produce about 1.2 million barrels per day, or about 9% of the imported oil consumed in the United States. According to a report released last week by the Toyota Motor Company, they will be idling their plants in Japan for 11 days in February and March to reduce output in the face of steeply declining global vehicle sales. The Japanese auto giant said the suspensions would affect production at all 12 of its directly operated domestic plants, which include four vehicle assembly plants and other factories that make transmissions, engines, and other parts. The closings are in addition to a three-day shutdown this month, January, at the plants Toyota had already announced. The move is unusual for a company that seemed unable to keep up with the demand for its fuel-efficient vehicles. But even strong players like Toyota have failed to escape the drastic slowdown in the auto industry brought about by the Bush recession. Hey, senior citizens of Champaign-Urbana area are invited for free coffee, donuts, games, and health care screenings once a week at the Provena Covenant Center for Healthy Aging. The new coffee shop program will begin on Wednesday, January 14th, and will be held every Wednesday thereafter from 7:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. at the Center for Healthy Aging, which is located at 410 East University Avenue in Champaign. Each coffee shop program will also feature a talk on a health topic. Also beginning January 14th, the Center for Healthy Aging will offer free health care screenings from 8:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. every Wednesday at the University Avenue address. A nurse will provide heart and lung assessments along with blood pressure readings, body fat analysis, and cholesterol and blood sugar screenings. Participants in the program can get one free screening a year. Pre-registration is required for the free screenings and is requested for coffee shop attendance by calling 337-202. That's 337-2022. And finally, this from Wednesday, January 7th, 2009 issue of the New York Times. 10 New Year's resolutions for union officials. Number 10, stop embezzlement. The U.S. Department of Labor has documented nearly $100 million embezzled from union members by union officials. Number 9, stop discrimination. Since 2000, labor officials have faced thousands of complaints alleging racial, sexual, and other forms of discrimination filed with the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Number 8, end bias politics. Federal records indicate that in 2007 and 2008, unions gave 90% of their political money to Democratic politicians, even though union membership is more politically balanced. Number 7, encourage merit pay. Union rules generally oppose raises and promotions based on individual employee performance, but mandatory seniority rules typically and often unfairly control who gets increases in pay and who's promoted. Number 6, provide a voice. Union rules often deny employees the right to deal directly with an employer about promotions, pay increases, time off, and other incentives and benefits. Union middlemen speak up for your union members. Resolution number 5, end high dues. Employees must support their local and international unions by paying dues and fees. In most states, a union can fire you if you refuse to pay them. And union dues and fees can range from hundreds to thousands of dollars each year. Number 4, in union gag rules. No normal employee should be restricted in what they can say or how they should act within reason. Number 3, allow growth. Unionized employees are generally denied the flexibility to broaden their experience because of too rigid job classifications. Number 2, provide fair representation. Union members have filed thousands of complaints against their leaders for failing to represent their interests. And for the number 1 resolution, the most important one of all, the Times suggests you go to www.unionfacts.com. I went to this website and found out that there's a bill in Congress which will pretty effectively eliminate the private ballot elections in union elections.
Yeah, the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yeah, the Employee Free Choice Act. Mm-hmm. Dave knows a lot more about that than me. That's today's news headlines.
Yeah, I've got some real problems with all those suggestions. All of them except for... which one here? Let's see. Provide fair representation. It is true that many you know, union members have filed thousands of complaints against their leaders. And, of course, this varies from union to union, like the United Electrical Workers Union, the one that is in Chicago where the workers are in the Chicago occupation. That is an extremely democratic union. In fact, so much so that they were expelled from the AFL-CIO back in the 1950s because the membership voted down members taking loyalty oaths to the government and stuff. And they basically told the AFL-CIO that, no, we're not going to do this because our members voted it down. They were expelled from the AFL-CIO.
Are these the guys at Rainbow?
At Rainbow.
The Rainbow Door and Window Company?
No, it's Republic Door and Window.
Okay, Republic.
Yeah. They're part of the United Electrical Workers. Now, unions like the Carpenters, which I'm unfortunately a member of, and SEIU, those are some really horrible unions as far as union democracy and stuff. Those type of unions are very counterproductive to the labor movement. And I always encourage rank and file members in those unions, if they have to please go ahead and file complaints. Now, number 10 one, stop embezzlement. It's really interesting. If you go online and look at what the rates are for bonding for particular employees in a particular industry or occupation, that the bonding rates for union officials are really low compared to people that work in the financial investment industry, to a lot of different corporate positions and industries. It seems like, you know, this is one thing that the corporate media has always thrown out there. And yes, of course, there's been embezzlement in unions, but it seems like it's a lot higher in the financial sector and other sectors than it is in the unions.
I would have to agree with that.
Yeah, let's see here. As far as racial, sexual, and other points of discrimination, well, let's compare this record to corporate America and see how many complaints have been filed. I guarantee you corporate America's rates a lot higher than unions, even though I will say that I do know personally of discrimination that has occurred in some unions here locally. And by all means, the employees need to and the workers in those unions need to put a stop to it. See, the other one, biased politics. Oh, yeah. As if corporations don't have biased politics.
Exactly.
Okay. It's encouraged merit pay. Well, there's a real problem with that one because, you know, the union contract basically provides a floor for all the workers. Now, there's nothing that union contract that prevents workers from moving up the ladder. You know, this happens all the time. People are promoted from the ranks into management and everything. So there's nothing stopping, that would, you know, definitely be a form of merit pay as a promotion. The union just provides a floor to where you can't, pit workers against each other and you know, drive down everyone's wage scales. Provide a voice. Union rules often deny employees the right to deal directly with the employer about promotions, everything else. Well, that's the whole point of the union middleman, as they've phrased it, because you have a lot better negotiation leverage if you basically negotiate together as opposed to one individual pitted against the boss. It's like Utah Phillips says, the definition of a union is something you get done together that you can't get done alone. And, of course, so this is very disingenuous at the best. Okay, in high dues, well, I mean, that is true that, you know, unions, you do have to pay dues for representation because you have to be able to support both the local and the national organization. And here's the thing. People who do not want to belong to the union in a particular workplace, they pay only half-rate dues. And why do they have to pay half-rate dues? Because they're benefiting from the union contract, even though they're not union members. So there is, if somebody doesn't want to pay the full dues, then there is that option. I think it's called fair share is what the term is for people that want to pay half dues. In union gag rules. Well, I've never heard of this. Now, of course, I know from personal experience in the Carpenters Union that a lot of times corrupt union officials will try to intimidate rank and file members, saying that they can be brought up on charges if they talk about certain things within the union. Well, the problem with that is, thank goodness, we've had real strong labor laws that defends a right of union members, rank and file union members, to have an absolute right to free speech. And believe me, if this wasn't the law, I would have been brought up on charges in the Carpenters Union definitely between 1998 and 2002, because I had a newsletter going on for 2 years, and believe me, the leadership didn't like it. I mean, especially my first issue when I published all their salaries and stuff that they were trying to deny the information to the members. So, no, that's not true. You have an absolute right to free speech under labor law. It's under the LMRDA, the Labor Management Reporting Disclosure Act of 1959. Allow growth. Okay, unionized employees are generally denied the flexibility to broaden their experience because of too rigid job classifications. Totally untrue. Again, this ties into merit pay we talked about earlier as far as, nothing stopping somebody from expanding their skills and or promotions. The union just provides a floor for all employees. What was this here? Union, let's see, provide fair representations. Yeah, we talked about that. And then lastly, number one, the most important one, go to unionplainfacts.com. Well, that's a very anti-union website. Now, the thing is, if you're in a corrupt union, this is a good source to go to find, kind of get the poop, if you will, on your corrupt leadership, because I have gone to the site several times to find out some information about the Carpenters Union, which I wasn't aware of. So in that sense, if you are in a corrupt, undemocratic union, this union... facts.com is a good website. But anyway, yeah, this is, of course, typical corporate media stuff, and you know, you got to basically look at it. But Tom, I really appreciate you bringing this in, because a lot of people, millions of people, read the New York Times, both nationally and internationally, and I think it's good to, you know, call them, you know, to task on this when they don't quite have really accurate information at the best. Okay, so now we will go to Workers Independent News. Okay, sorry folks, we're having a little technical problem here.
Is United Healthcare Workers West merging it with another California SEIU local? In response, the United Healthcare West Executive Board has petitioned the SEIU International for a disaffiliation vote. UHW West's board says in making this request for a disaffiliation vote, the board is not taking a position in support of leaving the SEIU International. SEIU International says the decision to reorganize the union's California long-term health care workers is consistent with SEIU's jurisdictional policies. Those policies consolidate SEIU locals based on similar work and geographic location. Mary Kay Henry is an executive vice president of SEIU International.
I'm quite confident that every voice has been heard, that there has been disagreements and people have different opinions. And the great thing about a democracy is that once the debate is over, there's a decision. The executive board has issued a decision today, and I believe that the leaders in our union are willing to abide by that decision. And we hope very much to work with United Healthcare Workers West officers in implementing this majority democratic decision that's been made.
United Healthcare Workers West declined to comment for broadcast, but the local's executive board immediately issued a statement Friday afternoon saying that it has sent a letter to SEIU President Andy Stern requesting that he schedule a disaffiliation vote for the local's 150,000 members. The United Healthcare Workers Board and members have resisted SEIU International's reorganization of California long-term healthcare workers, accusing SEIU International of anti-democratic internal practices. SEIU International's Mary Kay Henry says the action by the International is not anti-democratic, and this isn't an attack on UHW President Sal Roselli for his internal political dissent.
No, it is not. We have workers that earn $9 an hour without health care benefits in home care counties that we need to do better for, and we have nursing home workers that have to bring washcloths in because 18% of their industry is union in that state, and we need to have more power to deal with supplies and equipment and hours for residents.
In UHW West's letter to SEIU President Andy Stern, the UHW Executive Board says, quote, "We believe there is widespread and profound opposition within our membership to any efforts to dismember our local union or to take away its rights of democratic governance." From her perspective with SEIU International, Henry says that this entire process has been democratic, and she's proud of the way it was handled.
It makes me really proud of our union's ability to have a principle of what it is that we want to do in the best interests of workers, and then go through a very transparent and elaborate process for hearing all the different voices and then reaching a conclusion. And my deep hope is that we can focus on the external threat to the future of our members' lives and to the lives of their patients and the residents they serve. That's what we need to keep our eyes on, and our union's willing to make the tough decisions that make that possible.
Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News.
Okay, we're back, and before we go to Tom's poem, I just have to comment about that segment on SEIU. That's total BS. I tell you what, instead of me going into it in detail here on the air, the best thing to do is go and if you can go on the internet and pick up Democracy's Now's Thursday program where they interview, I had about a 15-minute interview with Sal Rosali. All the issues are discussed there. Also, Juan Gonzalez, who Amy Goodman's co-host on Democracy Now, also talked about how they did a similar segment about SEIU back, I think, 6 months ago or so, about when they tried to go in and take over the teachers' union in Puerto Rico against the will of the majority of the rank-and-file members of that union in cahoots with the Puerto Rican governor, who was very pro-corporate, anti-union. This really does come down to union democracy, and you got to remember that all those members of the National Executive Board of SEIU are appointed by Andy Stern. Right. And let's not forget, Andy Stern's the poster child of corporate America. They've constantly have put him in their publications saying he's their kind of union leader, and whenever corporate media is talking about some union leader who's their kind of guy, that alone should make you have to take pause and wonder. So with no further ado, we now go to the poem of the week by Tom Thomas. And the title of the poem for today is Just Maybe.
'Twas not since 1945 that we have lost the jobs we've lost. In the year 2008, so many in the can were tossed. They took more than 2 million jobs while promising to give more back. But all those liars gave to us was a bloody war in Iraq. 8 years of weeping tragedy perhaps have reached their final end. The devil soon will leave the throne, and the government can be our friend. When CEOs and zillionaires sucked all the blood we even had, America began to die because our leaders were so bad. Are we waking from the nightmare, or will politics be the same? Will we be getting our jobs back, or are they still pawns of the game? Some of us live in the ghettos, and some of us live in the streets. Those brothers and sisters have seen just too many lifetime defeats. But maybe brighter days will be. Maybe there's happiness ahead. Maybe all truths will be seen soon. Maybe our dream won't end up dead. Just maybe. Just Maybe was written at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois on January 8, 2009 and was first recited live today, January 10, 2009 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois. Thank you for listening.
Okay, and today, here over in Urbana, January 10th, hundreds of concerned citizens will gather at the Champaign County Courthouse in Urbana to voice their outrage over the continued war against the people of Gaza, Palestine, and their deep concern for the mounting death toll of civilians in Gaza. This rally is sponsored by the Muslim American Society, Urbana-Champaign chapter of MASUC, anti-war, anti-racism effort, or AWARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, and Students for Justice in Palestine. This event will be a nonviolent citizens action organized in conjunction with hundreds of rallies and marches throughout the United States and the world, calling for an immediate end of the inhumane military assault and bombardment of the civilians of Gaza while demanding an immediate end of the Israeli economic blockade of 1.5 million people in Gaza. This event is open to the public, and again, that's at the in front of the Champaign County Courthouse at from 12 noon today till 2 p.m.
And coming up on January 24th, the David Lippmann Counterintelligence Cabaret Comedy Theater. That's at 8 p.m. January 24th at the IMC stage. That's the Independent Media Center, 202 South Broadway in Urbana's old post office. And singing CIA agent George Shrub and satirical songster David Lippmann bring the Counterintelligence Cabaret to you. Get ready for high-end pop parodies and some very wisecracks. The veteran satirical songster is fired up about sweatshops, SUVs, and wars to defend sweatshops and SUVs. The show has delighted and terrified audiences throughout the free world and some pretty cheap places as well. Attendance is optional but strongly suggested. Lippmann's most recent CD is I Hate Walmart, and Shrub and Lippmann together released Live in Manhattan last year. Dave Lippmann has toured from San Francisco to Birmingham, England, from Australia to Germany to Central America. Current victims of his parody include the faith-based missile shield, global warnings, sports futility vehicles, and, of course, Walmart. Lippmann has been performing his brand of twisted musical comedy for over 25 years. Some of his material is based on his visits to war zones in Central America and the Palestinian territories. His recent travels in Venezuela are highlighted in a multimedia piece. And you can visit DaveLippmann.com for audio and video samples of the show. And for more information, contact Larry Keller at 359-2887 or Ed Hawks at 493-4654. And I'd like to say I've seen a few of his bits on YouTube and on the Internet, and he is quite funny, very satirical. Well worth checking out. And again, that's Saturday, January 24th at 8 p.m. at the IMC.
Yes, I've had the pleasure of seeing Dave Lippmann, and he's quite funny.
He is funny, yes.
And so anyone that can make that out, great. And also, if Larry Keller is listening, please, Larry, could you get us that underwriting announcement for the maintenance Brotherhood of Maintenance Away? We'd really appreciate it sometime. But thanks for Larry providing that. One more public service announcement here. Join auto workers and community supporters for a rally in Hart Plaza on opening press day, the North American International Auto Show. We will tell the media and the auto companies that we stand behind auto workers and all workers who are bearing the brunt of failed corporate policies. Destroying benefits and wages of those who build cars will not save the industry. We need a long-term plan that ties together the fight for health care, the fight for stable wages and benefits for working families, and the need for green conversion. With our industry in crisis, join workers who are calling for real transformation. Fight for health care for all, stand up for union jobs, and build green industry. And this is in Detroit at the North American International Auto Show, January 11th, which is tomorrow at 1 p.m. So if any of you are able to make it up there, or if you're listening, you're in the Detroit area, highly encourage you to come out and support that.
What is that, about an 8-hour drive?
More like six or six and a half,
six,
you know.
Half.
Yeah, about six and a half.
In the little town of West Seattle on the other side of Puget Sound. Little tiny house, little bitty kitchen. He was a Norwegian immigrant, gave all of his life to the logging and to the union. He carried his red card in the union every working day of his life. We sat in that little kitchen and he told me the story of the Spokane Free Speech Fight, 1910. I would not attempt to duplicate that rumbling baritone voice or that Norwegian accent, but is the story the way he told it. He said, oh, they boomed into Spokane and towns all over the West, looking for work in the silver mines up in the Coeur d'Alenes or in the logging camps or in the wheat harvest, the 110 cats, the great wheat lands that flow away south of Spokane called the Palouse. Well, you jungle up in the flops, wait for the weather to break, and then you go down on the street on Trent Avenue, and there were these rows of little shops called labor sharks. Well, labor sharks hold jobs. You give a labor shark $4, and it entitled you to a job, say, putting down a new mine shaft up in the Coeur d'Alenes. Well, you'd boom up there to that job, burning up your road stake as you went. You get up there, work a month, get paid, and then fired. Why? Because the foreman on the job was splitting the labor fees with the shark in town. So crooked as hell, they called it perpetual motion, where you had one job, one worker going to the job, one worker on the job, one worker coming back to buy another damn job. Well, he said that the union, the Wobblies, IWW, they came into those towns all over the West in Spokane and to build union hiring halls to control the conditions of their labor. Well, the one in Missoula, Montana was burned down. The one in Spokane was torn down by the law. So the Wobblies went down on the street, and they put up soap boxes, and they get up on the soap box and start windmilling, street speaking, exhorting, and they'd always set up right across the street from the Starvation Army. Be over there, Bible banging, and Jesus preached, and telling these working folks that to give what they had to Jesus to get pie in the sky by and by. My, my, that's a lie. Well, they were good at it. People flocked across the street to join a fighting union, which offers a more immediate form of salvation than the standard garden variety. scared the tar out of the city and out of the bosses, so they passed an ordinance against free speech, against speaking openly on the street. Applied to everybody except the Salvation Army. Now that's intolerable. We all know that the state can't give you free speech, and the state can't take it away. You're born with it, like your eyes, like your ears. Huh? We all understand that. Like old Campbell said, freedom is something you assume. Then you wait for somebody to try to take it away from you. The degree to which you resist is the degree to which you are free. So they said, okay, we're going to resist. They sent out a call to anybody cut loose from a job in the whole territory. They flooded into town on the freight trains, filled it up, put that soapbox up on Trent Avenue in defiance of the law, built a line four blocks down and four blocks up, and every one of those booming workers took their turn up on that soapbox. Had time enough to say, fellow workers, they got arrested.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, great. Okay, there you are. Okay, fellow worker Robert Austin, thanks for calling in. And this is a real pleasure for us to have you call in and talk about this event that happened up in Chicago in December. And anyway, I guess we need to start out. Can you just sort of identify yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, I'm Robert Austin. I'm in Chicago branch of the Industrial Workers of the World.
Okay, and you were, of course, there at the scene as far as with the Republic Windows occupation and stuff. Why don't you tell us kind of what happened at Republic Windows exactly led the workers to occupy the factory?
Basically, what happened was Republic Windows told the workers that they were going to close up shop, and instead of giving them their under the Warren Act, which is a as long as you have a contract within the state of Illinois, your employer has to give you 60 days before closing up. Well, they weren't given those 60 days. And they should have been granted health care benefits and vacation, and they weren't. They're basically given their last paycheck. And the reason why Republic Windows said they were closing up is because Bank of America, which was awarded $700 billion under the bailout, wasn't going to grant the loan to pay the workers, which totaled $1.75 million. And so the workers took this action, you know, as a direct means to get it. And afterwards, after the strike, the workers commented that in an interview that do they think they could have been able to win if they didn't use direct action, and they said that there would have been no way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. We just got a news story today that one of our co-hosts brought in that was saying that UE has filed some charges against the Republic Windows, and basically that it revolves around them moving equipment out of the factory and stuff, and that's probably that's the basis of the charges. They want those machines back and everything.
Yeah, that's basically what caught wind of the maneuvers of the bosses was, leading up to the strike, they started moving equipment out, and the workers were becoming increasingly worried. They were trying to follow the trucks to find out where they were going.
Mm-hmm.
And while Republic Windows said that they weren't making enough in sales, but they were making enough in repairs,
mm-hmm.
But they opened up another factory in Iowa where they're going to pay... There we have, it was 175 workers compared to the 275 that were at Republic. They're going to do the same amount of work and get paid, you know, half the price, no health care, no vacation. So,
yeah.
Some maneuvering on their part.
Okay. Yeah, that's, pretty, how should I say, typical. I mean, we know a lot of plants have moved completely out of the United States in order to try to do that sort of thing. This was just for a small factory in Chicago, this had this made a huge ripple. I mean, not just all over the country, but actually somewhat around the world. And what do you think that might have been?
I think it was because the action that they took was the first sit-down strike since, the 1930s.
Okay.
And then there was a wide mobilization from unions, activist groups, and there was, widespread report. And then, at the same time, it's definitely hard times for a lot of people. There's a lot of closures going on. You know, a lot of unions. I think if this wasn't UE,
mm-hmm.
A Democratic union,
mm-hmm.
this was any other union, this wouldn't have happened. There'd be no way.
Yeah.
Either the leadership would have turned it down, and, you know, it's like in Chicago we have, you know, here, the hotel employees and restaurant employees, they've had a strike at the Congress Hotel for 5 years now, you know, and this got resolved within a week, you know, through
action. Direct action gets the goods.
Yeah.
Okay, that kind of leads into another question here is, you know, of course, we saw both Rod Blagojevich and Barack Obama, you know, come out in, on television and support the strike, which, frankly, was quite a surprise for, you know, myself and a lot of other people. But what do you think their main motive was? I mean, it, the elections were over, so it wasn't about getting elected.
Yeah, I think it's, there's, I think, several things going on within politics. For one is the Republic windows used to be smaller, and it was part of a TIF plan,
okay.
Which is tax incremental financing. Basically, they're, in order to finance public projects, they use they'll tax a certain locality, and they'll take public funds that usually goes towards you know, schools, hospitals, or whatever, and they'll put it towards development. And it's, you know, a big problem with gentrification, mm-hmm. all sorts of issues in Chicago. So in 2000, between 2004. And I want to say 2004, Republic Windows was given $10 million of public funds to keep 600 employees until 2019. By when UWE started organizing in 2004, they were down to about 300 workers. And when this happened, there were 270 workers. And there's been no accountability of this in, within you know, the city government. So it's, you know, one level of government right there. Then I think for Blagojevich, you know, I thought it was interesting. The state of Illinois said that they were going to pull all support from Bank of America, all financing, and so forth. You know, and it was when Blagojevich gave his speech. It was the day before he got arrested.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that somebody else besides myself and a few of my friends down here in Champaign noticed the timing on that, considering he was under investigation for what, 2 or 3 years?
Oh yeah. And he was also trying to get a job with the SEIU at a higher office, but he was trying to have them create a job, and they're having difficulties creating a job for him because mm-hmm. They couldn't find what, you know, what position to put him in, because they already have enough positions that overlap on the top. So, I mean, that was the work that he was aiming for once he, you know, whatever happened with the court case or jail or whatever happened, you know, that's what he was aiming for. And I think for him it was a way of politically maneuvering into that leadership position with the SEIU. Hey, I'm down with labor, I'm here to support you, I've had your back. So I think that was his motive.
Okay.
I believe with Obama, Chicago and the state of Illinois has a green job initiative. We want to create green collar work, which is supposed to be manufacturing or refitting homes for, you know, ecological living. And so Republic Windows made Energy Star windows, and so Obama walked the Congress Hotel picket line, and he said, you know, before he was elected, that he'll walk it again when he wins. And so as part of his constituency has been labor. He has a lot to live up to. They're putting a lot of pressure on him. So I think for him it was more of a, you know, even before he steps in presidency, he's wanting to show that, you know, hey, I'm still for labor. You know, I think once he steps in the presidency, we'll see what happens. But
sure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that kind of, you know, brings another question here. Is that sort of did Chicago corruption through public financing come out during the strike? I mean, you kind of touched on this a little bit with the TIF districts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. It was, you know, with the TIF, and it's, the issue right now is, it's actually, to be exact, it's $9.6 million. So with this $9.6 million, it's basically what the city is saying right now is that they're not going to be able to get that back because, you know, they've changed, you know, the business has changed, it was sold, and they're saying that it'll be too hard to track it down and whatever else. And there's currently only one alderman who is speaking out against TIFs and calling for investigation. And so it's, you know, all the way through the alderman offices, it's, you know, there's been no challenge to the daily machine about, you know, unaccountable public financing. And, you know, this is just a project that plays right into this.
Okay. Well, that kind of leads into, you seem like you have sort of three culprits here, if you will. You had the company itself, you had the Bank of America, and the city of Chicago.
Yep.
So who do you think was really bottom line at fault here? I mean, a lot of people think, obviously, it was, of course, the company, but it seems like it's sort of a triad, if you will.
That's exactly what it is. It shows that, I think it just shows how corrupt the entire system is. It's the company and the banks obviously have similar interests, and they're able to use city government for their own sake, for their own advantages. You have people who, make millions of dollars a year, and they're able to influence aldermen. They're able to put, especially in Chicago, whoever they want to have legislation, to finance projects or whatever. And it's, when you have $10 million or $9.6 million just disappear and there's no accountability of it, and then, even going further into that, they're not able, the city of Chicago didn't offer a TIF to continue the development or pay back the workers. It's definitely a situation where, through and through, whether, Blagojevich or Ryan, with the state of Illinois, both have corruption charges. Obama, you look at Daley, he's been in office, I want to say this is his sixth term. it's definitely a system that it's very chaotic, and I don't think it's working very well.
Yeah, and then, of course, there was his father who was in, 20 years or more? But anyway, what was really interesting about this whole thing was that, now I did a little research, of course, as this was going down back in December, and it looked like that before the UE represented these workers, they were represented by some union that didn't even mention the word union or workers at their website. It was a joint pension board of something or other, and I did a little more digging. It turned out it was some kind of mob-connected union and stuff, and that probably would be a story in of itself as far as how the UE finally was able to represent these workers. And of course, as we well know, if they'd still been represented by that union, the old union, there's no way this would have happened. So tell me, now let's get into the real meat of the matter here, the real nuts and bolts. What is Republic Workers Solidarity Committee, and what tactics and strategy was developed during the strike?
IWW formed the committee called Republic Workers Solidarity Committee, and its goal was to basically provide support through, first, the flying squad in case of eviction, and then second, providing materials, and then third was outreach.
Okay, what was the flying squad exactly?
A flying squad is basically having a means of rapidly mobilizing in case of eviction or something happens.
Okay.
And there was one scare call that occurred where somebody from Interfaith Workers Group called up the committee. They're having a vigil. It would have been the second day of the occupation, and there were a lot of cops there. The workers were worried because a lot of the media left.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were concerned that if there was eviction, there would be nobody there to cover it. And so within an hour, we had about 40 people there, just through forming a network and having contact people with different organizations.
Okay.
And so that was our primary strategy was being able just to do work, focus on doing work. And it was interesting because a lot of the left, responded through newspapers,
okay,
publications, and they want to have like the perfect piece on it. But
but
what we wanted was, we're going to network, we're going to try to do as much work, we're not going to focus on writing articles, or the big demonstrations. We're going to focus on being there.
Okay. So you actually were inside the factory quite often, is that what you were telling me?
Yeah, we had there was a front lobby area where people were able to be at. As far as the actual factory, they had an agreement with management that nobody else would be allowed in the factory.
Okay.
But we would have somebody on site as much as possible. And the idea of this was rumor control, to make sure that somebody wouldn't call up the committee saying there's an eviction, there's something going on, and it's really not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And this way, just to have like a more on-the-ground heads-up of what's happening in case something goes wrong.
Okay. Well, what do you think this occupation has meant for organized labor and activists in general?
I think, one thing on the IWW side that I've definitely seen is, I feel that by helping UE, that if time comes where we need assistance, I feel that at least with the bonds that we made in Chicago, that there would definitely be support. And then it points to a direction is that I would emphasize that it was the structural the structure of UE that allowed this action to happen.
Mm-hmm.
When they started moving equipment, a lot of the workers are from Mexico, and there's a law there that if they start moving equipment out of the factory, you could occupy.
Oh, okay.
So things are resolved. So when they went to the organizers and they said, "Well, we want to do this," they're like, "Well, that's not a law here." And they said, "Well, we don't care. We're going to do that." And then the organizer said, "Okay, well, it's illegal, but we'll go through with it.
Okay.
And we'll do it." You know, and if it's any other union, it wouldn't happen.
Oh,
and so I think what this means for organized labor or just working folk in general is that if, you know, you look at what happened here, they had a definite victory. If we want accountable unions and we want to have a way to be able to combat, you know, all these closures, just a general rollback for working class people, we have to be able to have direct control of our union. We have to be able to, you know, skim off the people on the top. You know, like when you hear about Blagojevich wanting to go into the leadership of the SEIU.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we think that we're going to be able to win and be able to do these kind of actions when people like that are going to decide what kind of action we take as workers, there's no way that, you know, you could occupy a factory or you could take direct means of, you know, of resisting and win.
Well, I think that's the proof of that is the fact this is the first time this has happened since the 1930s. So,
yeah.
You know, this kind of also kind of begs the question is, did this this whole experience, did this make the workers of the factory more political in general?
Oh, definitely. They, similar to the IWW, they created, every worker is an organizer, and they have a lot of people that are coming out of this campaign that, you know, know how to organize, they want to do work. UE is currently talking about opening up a worker center, and also they've done a lot of work within the immigrant rights movement, and so they have all these people who took part in this occupation who want to keep working, and they're finding ways right now to plug them into things and, you know, keep it going.
That's great. I know, of course, the IWW is having their General Assembly in Chicago this year over Labor Day weekend, and maybe there can be some of that, taught at some of the workshops there. That'd be really something to look forward to. And lastly, we've been hearing kind of rumors and counter-rumors about the workers at factory actually wanting to take ownership. How true is that at this point in time?
It's, it was, from the start, that was talked about. The question was, would they be able to keep it open, and there was some concern about that. Would they be able to make enough money? You know, would they have to descale the factory and a lot of people working to maintain it? But my understanding right now is that there's a seed fund. It's the Window of Opportunity Fund, and it's through UE, and they've also had other financing, and just people have. So people that donated to the strike, their money is going, from what I understand, it's going towards this fund. So that is a definite, you know, possibility. That is, you know, from the start, that was something that was being looked at.
Okay, great. Well, listen, fellow worker Austin, thank you so much for calling in today. Just to let you and some of the other listeners know that when I sent out an announcement about this program on the Internet, that I got a response back from a listener in Germany, actually, that talked about a similar thing that happened in Germany. I think it was about a year and a half ago at a bicycle factory. And I'm sorry?
Yeah, the strike bike.
Yes, exactly. And so we might be getting... them, one of the representatives on the phone to talk, one of the workers on to talk about that, because I just, I really love this trend. I mean, this has been, how should I say, this relatively small factory in Chicago was the event that really shocked the working class and inspired, shocked the ruling class and inspired the working class definitely throughout the country. So
and called attention to a lot of problems.
Oh, indeed.
Oh, yeah.
So thank you so much, Robert, for calling in.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Miller kept the Senior Citizen Center for a long time up there in Seattle, Washington. Jack had spent most of his life in the forest as a logger or timber beast, they called him in those days, because you were treated like an animal. There were no bunk houses. He recalled sleeping on the ground with his fellow workers with their wet clothes in the rainforest piled in a heap next to the fire, hoping that they would be dry by the time to go to work the next day. Spoke many different languages in the forest, and they could hardly talk to each other. It was just like Lawrence. He said most of them had never been to school. Most of them couldn't read or write. Jack Miller could remember the Verona. There was a shingle weaver strike up at Everett, Washington. It was called the Everett Massacre. It's another one of those that didn't make it into the history books. The Wobblies, they chartered a steam launch called the Verona. And they had it sailed up there to Everett, bringing strike relief. And as the boat sailed into the pier, Sheriff McRae had ringed the whole pier with armed deputies. He just deputized every drunk in every bar in town and put a rifle in their hand. Well, they had surrounded the boat. And when they lowered the gangplank, Sheriff McRae walked to the end of it and said, "Who are your leaders here?" And they shouted back with one voice, "We are all leaders here." Well, that scared the tar out of the law, you know. And they began shooting. Those deputies began shooting. A lot of those Wobblies were killed. Some of the deputies were killed in the crossfire, though. So when the Wobblies and those that survived made it back to Seattle, they were arrested. And they were thrown in the Snohomish County Jail on a charge of murder. A whole bunch of them. Well, that jail was an all-steel jail. It was the newest affair, all made out of steel. It had just barely opened, so the heat wasn't on, and there was no blankets, and you couldn't get any smokes. So those Wobblies, they passed a note from one cell block to the other. And then by common consent, the next day, they were all gathered in the middle of each cell block. And when the noon whistle blew, they began to jump up and down simultaneously. Up and down, singing all the time. And finally they hit the resonating frequency of that jail and cracked the south wall. They broke the jail. And Jack Miller said, thus proving everlastingly what a union is. A way to get things done together that you can't get done alone. Now, Jack said, you know, we didn't have any intellectual life.
Okay, that was Utah Phillips and a little compilation there with Andy DeFranco, Why Come. And we have a few more little announcements here before we end the show. It's been 4 years since the murder of Hadi Saleh, the international officer of the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions. Not long after Hadi was killed, the Trades Union Congress in Britain published a book in his honor entitled Hadi Never Died. On January 4th, 2005, it began. Masked assassins broke into his home, bound his feet and hands, and blindfolded him. Then they tortured and burned his body and finally strangled him with an electrical cord. A life of idealism and selfishness, filled with solidarity and love for his family, country, and the labor movement came to a terrible, pain-filled end. The book, does much more than describe Hadi's murder. It tells the story of death and rebirth of the Iraqi trade union movement. Hadi Never Died is large format, full color paperback at Labor Start. Is pleased to be able to offer it to our readers for about $14.50, 10 British pounds sterling, with free shipping anywhere in the world. So go to laborstart.org and order Hadi Never Died.
Yeah, Dave, on a local basis here, there's a story that Maricall, a call center, has informed the state it will close its call center in Champaign by March 6th, and that would affect 74 workers. That call center had been in business for about 12 years, starting out in downtown Champaign, and then moved out to a current location out on Country Fair Drive. It was founded in 1984. It also has offices in Orlando, Florida, Lansing, Illinois, and St. Louis, and a couple in Indiana. And the company provides telemarketing services for companies, primarily in insurance, financial services, and telecommunications fields. And that's just word of the Maricall closing comes on the heels of the ACH Food Company's announcing impending closure of its Champaign plant, and the High Concrete Group announcing temporary closure of its Paxton facility, and several other major employers in the area, including Geldwin, Hobbyco, Carl Clinic, and Carl Foundation Hospital, have also announced layoffs in recent months.
Oh, boy. Okay, Tom?
Have you ever considered being a WEFT airshifter and creating your own show on community radio? WEFT is now selecting applicants for our next series of airshifter orientation trainings beginning on Wednesday evening, January 28th. Pick up an application at WEFT 113 North Market Street in Champaign, or request it via email at airshiftertraining@weft.org. Applications must be postmarked by January 15th to be considered, so don't delay.
Okay, news from Neptune is going to be having a two-hour show next Saturday. The Labor Hour won't be on next Saturday, but we will be back the following Saturday with some more good labor news. And we got some really good interviews going to be coming up here in the next several months. So stay tuned. We're going to leave you with a little Utah Phillips, Joe Hill.
I dreamed of all Joe Hill last night. Live with you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake, Joe, great God, says I am standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead. The copper bosses, they framed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I did not die. Says Joe, I did not die. And standing there just as big as life, smiling with his eyes, says he what they forgot to kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego on up to Maine, in every mine and mill where workers strike and organize, says he, you'll find Joe Hill. Says he, you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, live as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.